is now in session. We have before us, well, first of all, let me do attendance. Representative Kawasaki, Wilson, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Guttenberg, Edgman, Coring, and Seaton, and Co-Chair Gatto. We also have in the audience, for one more day at least, Representative Fairclough. Certainly appreciate you doing that for us. Today we will hear from British Gas, and ready to testify, I believe, online is Dana Keene. Dana Keene, can you hear me? Is that a no?
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, this Representative Gatto, can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. It's actually David Keene.
David Keene, well.
Yep.
Okay, we're not going to change our records, but we will call you David now that we know who you are. I appreciate that, and do you have a presentation that includes slides?
Yes, that should have already been sent to the committee. Yes, sir.
I don't have someone right here to... Just a moment. To do the slides. Who would that be?
No. We can look.
Okay, we have the handouts, but as far as projecting them for the audience, we do have a set of copies of the slides, and that's fine.
Okay.
Let me just see if I can make an arrangement here.
Do you want me to?
Yeah, would you please?
Do you have the skills?
One.
Do you need a set?
Yes.
We're short one set. Hold on, David. We're going to get to you in a minute.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
And while we're chatting with you, what is your affiliation?
My affiliation is I'm Vice President of Policy and Corporate Affairs for BG, North America, Caribbean, and Global LNG.
Okay. Corporate Affairs, too. Wonderful. Now, I understand, and the official name of the company is BG and not something else?
That's correct. It is not British Gas.
And just curious as to what happened between when it was British Gas and BG.
BG, or British Gas, went through a series of what was known in the UK as a series of demergers back in the 90s. And as a result, what resulted in BG Group PLC is basically the exploration and production arm of what used to be British Gas.
Well, that is very helpful. We rarely hear the word demergers, but it's certainly a great way to explain it. So I appreciate that. We have a person that's going to testify behind you that has some deadlines.
Okay.
So let me just ask Kathy just a moment. So just hold on. Kathy Forrester, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Would you like to go first?
I will do whatever you guys want me to do, but I do have to be off the line and into another hearing at 3:30.
How long is your presentation?
I was told to be on the line to answer questions, so it can be zero.
You know, that is some really good news. Well, let's do this, Kathy, then. When you have to leave, you have to leave. That can't be helped. But I would appreciate it if you would just jump on the line and say it's necessary for you to leave in case we lose track of the time. Meanwhile, we'll go back to David Keene. David, we're going to put you up first here. So you've already explained about demergers, and we have a set of slides in front of us from BG Group. And we have someone that is actually presenting on your behalf so that the slides appear in color up on the screen. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and welcome to the Resources Committee. Welcome to Alaska. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Houston, and I apologize for not being there in person. I had some other personal commitments that wouldn't allow me to travel to Alaska to be there in person. So I apologize for that.
Well, that's okay. Just so you know, the sun is shining here, too.
It's not shining here.
Oh.
And it's shared. There was a question whether that was Houston, Alaska, or Houston, Texas.
Wait. You are familiar with Houston, Alaska?
No, I am not.
We have one. Did you know that? And I don't think we copied from Texas. I'm not sure Texas didn't steal it from Alaska. There isn't any record.
Well, they may have. There's a there's actually a street in New York City, which I believe is where you're from.
It is.
That's actually called Houston.
And you're absolutely right. You certainly get around a bit. So that's great. We have a great background. Everyone's smiling here. They're facing up at the presentation, and we are ready to go, so you have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is David Keene, Vice President of Policy and Corporate Affairs with BG North America, Caribbean, and Global LNG. What I thought I would do anyway is walk through a series of slides. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through them, but I do think it's important to give the committee a feel for who BG is and who BG Group is. And if you go to, I'll skip over the legal disclaimer. So we can go to straight to page or slide three. And the first bullet indicates that BG is, we're an integrated gas major. And what that means is that we're involved in the exploration and production of natural gas and other hydrocarbons around the world. We're also involved in transportation of those hydrocarbons or natural gas to the market. And the last step in that process is we're involved in selling it. So we're integrated, and unlike some of our competitors, BG is actually more interested in trying to find gas than oil. And if you look at 2006, I believe around 73 to 74% of all the hydrocarbons we produced were natural gas related rather than oil related. So,
and David,
we are a natural gas major, and I'll talk a little bit about the strategy in just a moment.
And David, when you find oil, do you process it? Do you have a whole organization that also processes the oil, or do you find somebody to take it off your hands?
We find somebody, Mr. Chairman, to take that off our hands, and we'll sell that to a third party. We have no refining capabilities or anything like that.
Thank you.
And if you look at the second bullet, the activities that we're involved in, again, exploration and production, which is what brings us to Alaska, liquefied natural gas. BG is the largest supplier of liquefied natural gas to the United States, and in 2006, we supplied 49.8% of all the LNG coming into this market. We're involved in transmission and distribution of natural gas. We're one of the largest distributors of gas in Brazil, one of the largest distributors in India. We're the largest gas distributor in Buenos Aires, so we have a lot of experience with that. And gas-fired power generation. We just purchased two power plants in the northeastern part of the United States and are actually now looking to close on a third that will hopefully close before the end of this month. So we're active in that. We're a top 20 UK company. We're traded on both the London Stock Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange. And today we have a market capitalization of somewhere around $45 billion, depending upon where the exchange rate is. We're active in 25 countries on five continents. And I should say that we do all of this with roughly 6,000 people. So we're not by any means a super major, but we've been very, very successful since the demerger of the old British Gas in taking a monopoly gas provider and becoming very entrepreneurial and growing our business quite dramatically. Now, if you go to slide four, that's really our strategy. And as I mentioned, we consider ourselves an integrated gas major, and all that really means is that our job is to go out and explore and find natural gas and then find ways in which we can connect that gas to markets. So we have to secure the resources, which is what we hope to do in Alaska when we begin our gas drilling exploration, which will begin in next year in the foothills of the North Slope. We have equity reserves. We also contract other supplies that we sell to markets, and then we feel like we've got the skills to get them to market. And as I mentioned, one of the ways that we find or have done this in the last several years is with LNG. And of course, a lot of resources worldwide are becoming more difficult to find, and when you do find them, they're not in areas that are that have natural markets. So it's convenient to liquefy it, put it on ships, and then take it to very large and liquid markets like the United States or Europe. If we go to the next slide, this is really our focus. We have a North America focus, and as you would expect, a UK Europe focus. But we're also heavily involved, as I mentioned, in South America and in India, and we are one of the largest players in terms of LNG in the Atlantic Basin. We're the second largest producer also of natural gas in Trinidad and Tobago. We're and also one of the largest producers of natural gas in the offshore in the UK. So the slide, the next slide, which should be, I'm missing my slide numbers, but the next slide shows the countries of current operation. And as you can see, they span quite an array of countries in which we operate. And as I said, we're operating currently in 25 countries. And the majority of this are involved in exploration and production of natural gas and hydrocarbons. The next one is our LNG portfolio, which is which shows where we're involved. If you look at Atlantic LNG or ALNG down in the bottom of the Atlantic Basin there, that's all of our Trinidad production. We are currently, like I said, one of the largest providers of LNG out of Trinidad. Egyptian LNG, I think that was a project that we were actually able to deliver in record time. We actually had our first shipment of LNG from the time we had the idea to get involved in exploration and production in Egypt, which is offshore in the Nile Delta. From that time till we had first production of LNG was 5 years. So it was quite an amazing feat to be able to take lessons learned in the past and be able to develop a project, an LNG project that is world scale in a relatively record period of time.
David?
Yes.
Since you are such a productive company with regard to LNG, when you look at the Alaska Gas Pipeline, are you looking at it in any way as converting it to LNG or strictly to leave it as high-pressure gas in a pipeline?
Well, we're open to both suggestions, Mr. Chairman. I think, clearly what we're interested in right now is making sure that we have a pipeline. Which is our primary focus today, but we think that the LNG option is interesting, and we're certainly not opposed to looking at that as well.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So that's our portfolio. You can see our entry terminals in Lake Charles, Elba Island. Lake Charles, when we acquired the entry capacity at Lake Charles, it had a baseload send out of 630 million cubic feet of gas a day. We have since grown that to today, where it's has a baseload send out of 1.8 BCF a day, with storage having increased from 6 BCF up to 9 BCF. So we've been very, very successful at growing that system. And then in Elba Island, which is operated by Southern Natural LNG, which is a subsidiary of El Paso, we have also been active in expanding that facility, and we are the cause, or we caused a pipeline to be built from Elba Island going south into southeastern Georgia and northern Florida. And this pipeline will be up and running in May of this year. And for the first time, Florida will have access to gas supply from an area of the country other than the Gulf of Mexico. And I think that's critically important, given what happened a few years ago with regards to the to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And we were able to then divert some supplies that were going into Lake Charles to Elba Island so that we were able to keep some of the power plants in the southeast running, which was I think, quite an amazing feat given the fact that we had lost a considerable amount of production out of the Gulf of Mexico, around 15 to 19 BCF a day. The next slide shows the global gas trade, which is really the recent past. And what we're talking about here is gas up until just recently has pretty much remained within its regions and hasn't really moved. So it's something that that we're seeing some changes develop right now. If you'll go to the next slide, you can see what I'm talking about, that we're seeing more interaction from other suppliers to other markets around the globe. And this is something that that has just recently started to transpire over the last 1 to really 2 to 3 years. And it's important for Alaska because Alaska's supply to the lower 48 is going to be in competition with supplies that are coming out of areas like Equatorial Guinea or Nigeria or Egypt or the Northwest Shelf or wherever. So I think that's important, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk with this committee today, because I think it's important that we have a vehicle for moving the debate forward and really focusing on what's important, which is getting a pipeline built from Alaska. Now, the next slide, which is it talks about our supply projects, which are focusing primarily on LNG, and again, it's Atlantic LNG. I'm not going to go through all the details, and Egyptian LNG, which I've already mentioned. The next slide is our business in LNG business in the U.S., which, as I mentioned, Lake Charles, because of our involvement with that facility, we've been able to expand it twice and add additional storage. Phase two, again, took it up to 1.8 BCF a day of sustainable send out. Elba Island, as I mentioned, we are in the process of expanding that to supply gas to the southeastern part of the United States.
David, let me interrupt you for a second.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Generally, the ground rules we've had here are allow speakers to go on, and then we interject occasionally with some questions, and you're not here to see them, so occasionally I'm just going to have to jump in on you. We have Representative Guttenberg who wanted to ask you a question.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And when I was growing up, Houston Street was a place that we visited regularly. On slides 8 and 9, can you give me a general view on what time spans you're talking about here from the recent past to the gradually evolving?
From the recent past, well, again, that the global gas market was, again, very isolated, so that typically gas in North America pretty much stayed within North America. You saw some imports into the United States, well, actually, you still do from Canada, which is our largest importer. You saw some imports from Mexico, but typically you didn't really see gas supply going from Trinidad to Japan, for example, nor did you see gas that was going from Algeria really go to Japan. It was primarily focusing on going into the European markets, and the same thing with the Far East. Southeast Asia supplied Asia, Indonesia supplied the Japan, Korea, Taiwan markets, and you really didn't see much interaction between those markets. In the evolving business that we're seeing gas supply, the way gas is sold worldwide is changing quite dramatically. And we've had a lot actually to do with that. I think around 25 or 30% of all of the spot sales into the Far East were sales by BG that were coming from primarily Trinidad or from Egypt. So we're seeing this from a firsthand perspective, that the market is changing considerably. And again, when you look at the United States and the lower 48, we're seeing gas supply remaining relatively flat. We're seeing gas demand continually increasing, and it's growing at a 1 to 1.5 or so to 2% a year, depending upon the region of the country. So at some point in time, the gas supply the demand for gas is going to have to be met from somewhere. Clearly, because of our interest in Alaska, we would like to see a gas a method for getting the gas from the foothills of the North Slope to the lower 48. Does that answer your question, Representative Guttenberg?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. And then I think I was talking about where we are in the market summary and the U.S., et cetera. The next slide just shows our share of U.S. LNG imports. I don't want to belabor that. The next one is our shipping capacity. Unlike some of our competitors in this market, BG does believe in managing and controlling its ships. We currently have 6 owned vessels, and we control currently 14, so the rest are either on medium to long-term charters. We are receiving another ship, 2 more ships this year, and then we just placed an order with Samsung Heavy Industries for 2 more that will be delivered in late 2009 and early 2010.
David, this is Representative Gatto. We've got a couple of questions, and the first one goes back to slide 9. It shows we have four receiving terminals on the West Coast and four receiving terminals that are not on the East Coast. They seem to be in the Midwest. Can you, first of all, if we have four, what look like four on the West Coast, are they all operating below their capacity, which is what I've heard? And the four, which are in the Midwest, how are they getting there?
Mr. Chairman, these arrows aren't representative of terminals on the West Coast or terminals on the East Coast. These are arrows are showing that big blob in the middle is really the U.S. market. So it's really showing supply coming from either the Far East or from South America going into the market potentially in the western side of the United States. That probably would be through Mexico. The arrows on the right side of that blob really don't indicate any import terminal. What they're reflecting is supply positions coming from other countries into the U.S. market.
Okay, and I had another question, and it's off task here, but on the next slide, number 10, you have a ship there. The question has come up in previous testimony about reflagging ships that were already were initially flagged as a U.S. ship, but are no longer flagged U.S. Have you ever had an experience about whether that's easy, difficult, or impossible?
Mr. Chairman, I really couldn't answer that question. I don't know whether it would be easy or not. We have not had to go through that, so I'm not sure. I know that the old previous flagged LNG vessels have been around for quite some time. And I mentioned that we are placing an order for two new vessels that will be dual fuel diesel electric that are going to be really state-of-the-art and will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reduce fuel consumption as well. So that all of that goes into the mix in terms of shipping and the costs that are involved with the shipping as well.
Okay, and you read my bio and you knew I was from New York and you probably know I was a fireman. And this next question has everything to do with a very serious accident on an LNG tanker. Let us just say that under the worst circumstances, it received what the fire department calls a blevy, and that is where a pressure vessel bursts, releasing the contents at an enormous rate. What is a scenario that you see when that happens, as far as if it happens on a dock or if it happens at sea?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, if LNG is not transported or stored under pressure, it's probably under maybe 2 pounds of pressure just to for venting purposes, but it's not what you would consider a high pressure fuel. And the reason why it's liquid is that it's been super cooled to about minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, which turns it into turns the methane into its liquid form, which really looks just like boiling water. I do want to say that in the 44, 45 years of marine transportation of LNG, there's never been a serious incident or accident where a major loss of cargo has occurred. And this represents more than 100 million miles of transportation and over 80,000 cargo voyages. So it's the transportation of LNG is and has a very, I think, well-proven safety record. In terms of other issues, that's why there are exclusion zones and things around these vessels, although I will say that LNG is, as a hydrocarbon, is not as volatile as a lot of other hydrocarbons that are typically going into many U.S. ports today.
Thank you, David. This is Co-Chair Johnson, and the Representative Gatto had to step out. So if you'd go ahead, and unless I see any other questions, go ahead and proceed with your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Again, the share of our U.S. LNG imports, or the ships, rather. If we can go to the next slide, which it shows 14. The reason why I'm here is because of our interest in the foothills area of the Alaska North Slope. We have 2.1 million acres that we will be exploring on. We're in partnership with Anadarko and Petro-Canada for that in that foothills area. The other slide there, or the other label at the top, is the eastern north slope, and we're in partnership there with just Anadarko, and we did drill our first well, which is a predominantly oil play, but we did drill the first well this this past winter. So we are doing that, and as I mentioned, in the foothills, we hope to be in a position to drill our first well, exploratory well, next year, and then we hope to be moving forward from there. Now, the last page on this slide is what I call our key messages, and that is BG is, as an active new explorer in Alaska, we are extremely interested in the pipeline. We are investing in Alaska. We're a leading player in the natural gas value chain in terms of liquefaction or exploration and production. I do want to say that BG Group, we support the Alaska Gas Line Inducements Act. We feel that it is the right way to move forward, and that it is it will result ultimately in a pipeline. Now, some of the caveats that we had, you know, we had very serious concerns about the process that took place over the last couple of years, in which the new entrants were excluded from really having a seat at the table in terms of what were some of our concerns. We feel that the new pipeline contract that comes out of all of this has to provide a level playing field for all of the participants, not just a certain few, but that everyone that's involved, whether it's the big three or whether it's the new explorers or whether it's consumers, that everybody has a level playing field for all the participants. Also, and I think this is critically important for us, is that whatever results, that we have to have reasonable certainty that when we discover gas, that we will have the ability to secure access on or capacity on the new pipeline to be able to get the gas from the foothills to the lower 48. And as I've met with several of the representatives here, I've met with the governor. We encourage the state to enter into discussions with the independent pipeline companies. We think that's probably the best way forward, not only for us but also for the state. And that would conclude my presentation. So I'm more than happy to try and answer questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, you operate pipelines, and we're looking at possibility of, you know, cap and trade by the time we, on CO2 emissions, by the time we get down the line. Do you have did your company have a strategy for reducing combustion compression release or some other way for powering in a remote area? To save on that expense for, you know, either cap and trade purchase of CO2?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, at this time I really couldn't answer that question. I think that I'd be more than happy to get back to you on that.
Follow up. Mr. Representative Seaton?
Yeah, and I'd appreciate that because I was encouraged that you're talking about new tankers. LNG tankers, and that's one of the efficiency parts that you're working on there, and we're looking at trying to figure out what strategies are available for transmission down a pipeline as well. So if you have anything, please do get back to us. So my understanding is you're talking to us today as an explorer producer, not as someone who's looking at submitting a proposal for a license. But I was wondering if you have any comments on any of the specific items in the AGEA bill that you see as problematic, either in the what are called the must-haves starting on page 3 or the evaluation criteria?
I think one of the again the I think this is a good vehicle for getting everybody to the table. and for everybody to sit down and discuss what the real issues are. You know, as I was reading the House version of the bill, and I looked at the very first part of the bill under Section 43.9.90.010, and you look at the purpose of this, it's really to get a gas pipeline developed. And I have listened to testimony over the last several days, and I think that there is a tendency, and it's understandable, that we can be dragged into the weeds on a lot of the details in terms of what it is each one of us want. At the end of the day, the real objective needs to be that we, as an explorer, all the other noise doesn't really mean anything unless we have a pipeline. And I don't think it really means anything to Alaska unless there really is a pipeline. So I would encourage the committee to really focus on getting the vehicle together that is then allows the state to issue or receive applications and then get to a point where they can issue a license. Because I think once you get the license, that's where a lot of the devil in the details is going to be. Right now, you know, there are some things, yes, that we would like to see. I think, you know, the fiscal certainty, you know, clearly that's an issue for BG. We would like to have a longer period of time than the 10 years. Probably the state would like to have a shorter period of time than 10 years. But when we look at this, it's not going to mean anything if we don't have a pipeline. So I would encourage the state to continue to move forward on that. Another concern we have with regards to that fiscal certainty is, as a new explorer, I mentioned that we are going to be drilling our first exploratory gas well probably next year, and Anadarko is the operator, I should say, of this. The BG is not the operator, but we are a one-third interest owner in it. So in drilling the well, if we are successful and we happen to put her in the right spot and we find some gas, then we're probably going to have to go back the following year to try and delineate the wells and determine whether or not we have a real discovery of commercial quantities of gas. And then probably the third year after that is when we'd be in a position to really start trying to do something. So my concern is we may not be physically in a position to try and secure capacity during the initial open season. And we feel that as long as we are diligently looking for gas supply, then we shouldn't be penalized in terms of fiscal certainty with regards to tax rates and the like. And I think that's something that would be that is one of our biggest concerns with regards to the bill right now. And I think it's really making sure that everybody that's actively involved is again on a level playing field. The rolled-in rates, clearly we support rolled-in rates. We think that that's the right way to go. We think that at the end of the day, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, assuming that this is an interstate pipeline or an international pipeline, will be involved in setting the rates. And as we go through the process, once the licensee is determined, then all of us, including BG, our partners, everybody involved in this process will have an opportunity to weigh in on rate design and what the most appropriate rate is. So, again, I think it's something that we have to be careful that we don't get into a position where we're dragged into the weeds on trying to determine rate design on a bill that is really there to encourage getting a vehicle or getting a licensee in place that can then help us get a pipeline. The other issue that we have is really on the under Section 43.90.160, which is the 60-day review period. If we get more, or if the state receives more than one application, it may be maybe physically impossible to review those applications in a 60-day period, because I think you're talking about applications that could be, you know, gosh, who knows? I mean, it could be up to 1,000 pages long And it could be very, very time-consuming and difficult to go through and provide reasonable and educated comments in a short period of time. So that I hope that answers your question, because that's really where we are on this at this time.
Thank you, David. I have a question. I want to make sure that I understood your rolled-in rates comment. It said I think I heard you say you supported rolled-in rates, but then I thought I heard you say that FERC was going to do it and it shouldn't be in the bill. Is that an accurate assessment, or did I hear that wrong?
No, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. That's through the chair of the that's not correct. We support rolled-in rates, what I meant to say, we support rolled-in rates. The FERC is going to help determine what the actual rates should be. And I think having it in the bill is extremely helpful.
Okay, thank you. And I will let you know that Representative Gatto is back, and I am turning the gavel over to him.
Oh, thanks, Mr. You're Co-Chair. I did have a question on slide 10. And it's a picture of the Egyptian LNG ship.
Okay.
And in the background of the ship is one heck of a flare.
Yes.
Is that typical for the operation there? Is that all gas that just simply has to be flared because there's no way to capture it?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that's a plant upset. Because typically you wouldn't be flaring unless there's a reason or an issue to do that.
So that's not a continuous operation. That's just to handle an overpressure or...
It's some sort of an upset in the plant where they have to flare it.
Okay, and I apologize for being missing, but we're back now and don't know where we are. What slide are we on now?
We're done.
Well, I have a few slides I've got to read here.
Okay, question in the meantime.
But I do have some questions, and I'll go first to Representative Johnson.
Thank you. David, are you familiar with the ruling of the California Coastal Commission recently where they ruled that the LNG plant in California should be denied a license, and it's the second ruling of a California commission? Do you see that as problematic? Are you familiar with their process there? Can you enlighten us a little bit on what we're looking for? Will we ever have a LNG plant in California?
Well, Representative Johnson, through the chair, I can't speak for the particular project themselves, and I'm not that familiar with California, with their approval process. I can say that we believe it's difficult to site LNG facilities on the west coast of the U.S. And I think it's very difficult, as this particular project is seeing. It looked like the perfect project, and you wouldn't have any, or wouldn't have expected any problems with it. So, but I can't speak for them or for the California Coastal Commission and what they ruled. I just think it's difficult to see any LNG projects on the U.S. side of the U.S. West Coast.
Mr. Chairman, if I could you explain some of those difficulties? Are they regulatory, or are they public opinion? Where do those difficulties fall? Can you kind of explain that? I mean, it's easy to say it's difficult and you don't see any happening. can you expand on that a little bit? Can you tell us some of those problems?
Well, it's the same thing on the East Coast, of the U.S. It's not the regulatory side of this. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has approved, I think, in the neighborhood of 50 or so LNG receiving terminals in the United States. We don't expect that you'll see maybe four or five of those get built, and the reasoning behind that is that there's a tremendous amount of public opinion that is against having LNG facilities built in their communities. And even though these facilities operate safely around the world and operate in the center of Tokyo essentially, and have for a number of years, there is a tremendous amount of public opposition to having LNG facilities in their neighborhoods, and you know, I think that's the biggest hurdle to overcome. Again, it's not a regulatory hurdle; it's a court of public opinion hurdle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
David, this is Representative Gatto. Los Angeles must be a huge consumer of natural gas. Are they receiving their gas through pipelines from Colorado, Wyoming, and over the mountains, and from anywhere else, or where? Or mostly from Mexico?
Well, Mr. Chairman, most of it comes from the southwestern U.S. Still, there is now gas coming in from the Rockies. Gas does go into California from Canada through the Pacific Gas Transmission System. It comes in through El Paso and out of the southwest on Transwestern, Kern River, which comes in from the Rockies. So it's receiving its pipeline or receiving its gas supply via pipeline, predominantly from the United States. It's not getting really anything out of Mexico, but it will once the LNG facility is up and running.
So the ever-growing metropolis of Los Angeles, which is in need of more and more water, more and more gas, probably more and more gasoline, has a long-term plan, I would think. Is their long-term plan include LNG imports?
The last plan I saw from the California Energy Commission was, yes, it does include LNG imports. But, again, I'm not an expert on California, so...
And I bet you're not an expert on windmills, but if you were, what percentage of the power requirements for the Los Angeles basin could be had from windmills? Not much,
sorry,
I'm guessing. Not much.
I really couldn't answer. If I answered, it would be just a guess.
Well,
it would be such a guess that it wouldn't even be worth saying it. So I honestly can't answer that question.
The emphasis was that they will be a long-term consumer of fossil fuels, and the question is they have to face the reality that fossil fuels are the future, no matter how much increase we get in the other available sources.
Yes, sir. You're absolutely correct. They can't build enough windmills or enough solar cells or enough photovoltaic cells to be able to supply the energy needs of California, which, when you look at its GDP, is roughly it's larger than Italy. So, it's an enormous consumer of energy and a very limited producer of energy.
And my guess is they won't be building a whole lot of coal-fired power plants.
I would take that bet.
So, are they even willing to produce their own electricity within the borders, or do they simply want it created somewhere else and then sent in by power lines?
No, Mr. Chairman, they do have power plants and have built power plants since the energy crisis of 2000. So they are encouraging the construction and development of new gas-fired power plants in California.
Okay, I did notice that General Electric had built a rather huge turbine. Which was cooled with steam. Are you familiar with that one?
No, sir.
Okay, what I see is that, you know, in the future, it's even bigger gas-consuming turbines and not an exotic supply except in the 1% and 2% range.
Mm.
Let me just switch over to the ships. As you build new ships, do you retire old ones or just run them all?
Part of the strategy for building the two new ones in late 2009, early 2010, is we will retire some of the long-term charters that we have.
When you retire a ship, does it go on the open market for someone to purchase, or does it go to the graveyard for scrap?
Usually there is a market for somebody to purchase it.
Are the ships you're retiring built outside of the USA?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Well, I mean, all of the ships that we... I should point out there are no U.S.-flagged LNG carriers today. And there are some that were built in the U.S., but they were built back 20 or plus years ago. So all of the newer LNG ships that you see are all from other countries.
Does an older ship have a life expectancy beyond which it may no longer be allowed to remain in service?
Mr. Chairman, I'm really not an expert on the ships, so I really couldn't answer that question. I can find out for you, but I just can't answer that right off the top of my head.
And I appreciate that. It's just trying to find out some information, and you just happen to be the one that was from a gas company that shipped LNG, and it was just easy for me to ask you, and I recognize that you didn't come on here to talk about retired ships. And so I apologize for that. I do have some other gas questions, but they're mostly going to be for Kathy Forrester. And as there, so I do have someone on the committee here with a question. Representative Wilson would like to ask you a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, I know that you are definitely in favor of the rolled-in rates. What would happen if that changed? And you're up here exploring, and you've got all these plans. And what would happen if it wasn't rolled-in rates? How would that change your status of being up in Alaska?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, clearly it would add more uncertainty to our business. And when you look at capital investment programs and where we're going to invest money around the world, anytime uncertainty is added, it makes it more difficult to make a decision in terms of what you're going to do and where you're going to drill, et cetera. The issue that we would have is, you know, what are the rates going to be? So if we're in the North Slope and we're drilling and we're actively looking for gas, it would be helpful, or I should say it's not helpful, to not know what your transport rates are going to be. And if you get tagged with the incremental rates, then it may simply make it uneconomic.
Thank you.
And I'm going to go back to slide 15. It says BG supports AGEA and the development of a pipeline, and then it ends in the word but. And two lines down, it said contract must provide a level playing field for all participants. It's been my impression that that's exactly what AGEA does.
Yes, it does. I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman. It does. Again, we support AGEA. But really, it should have been in front of the first hyphen there, okay, where we had serious concerns about the previous draft contract. We absolutely believe that AGEA does provide a level playing field for everybody involved. AGEA, again, opens the process for everybody to provide input into the how this process is going to work, what it's going to look like. We will have many opportunities once the applicant has been selected or the licensee and the license has been awarded to provide comment that will be regulatory in nature to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in terms of what the rates are going to be, how high the rates are going to be, whether or not the pipeline is being built in a prudent, cost-effective manner, which, believe me, I've heard others say that only certain companies can do that. We're going to have an active role, and we'll take an active role in determining whether or not the rates are just and reasonable. And I certainly believe that the big independent pipeline companies are best placed to do that. So I apologize for the but there, but I do want to make sure that it's clear that BG is supportive of AGEA. We do believe it gives provides all of us with a level playing field. We do think that once the contract is or the license is awarded, that we will have reasonable certainty that when we discover gas, that we will have access to the pipeline capacity.
And that is our goal, too. We have something. We have the rolled-in rates in the bill right now. We have the 15% maximum. That is there for independent people like yourself who will want to add to the pipeline capacity. The only question is, when we fill up the pipeline, I mean, I hope we fill up the pipeline, but if we did, then it might shift after that 15% to incremental rates. That would be truly a fairly high toll. Are you willing, well, I know I can't commit you, but are you willing to simply explore that possibility that says Well, let me back up. Do you have any leases right now?
Yes.
On the North Slope?
Yes. I mean, we have, again, we have several leases that we're looking at. We have 2.1 million acres in the foothills area of the North Slope that we will be exploring on.
Okay. And I'm taking it the reason you're talking to us because you have a strong interest in building a pipeline.
We have a, yes, sir. We have a strong interest in seeing that a pipeline that provides new explorers and people that will take Alaska into the 22nd century with gas supply, that we have access to capacity on a fair and reasonable basis.
Okay, and I like the way you talk because that's what we're dreaming of, too. It's hard to get all the way to the 22nd century, but the 21st century is pretty young yet, so we're looking for gas to be produced before 2020, certainly, and carrying us out for at least 40 years. Representative Guttenberg, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Keene, you're not looking to build the pipeline itself. You're just looking for a pipeline that allows you to have reasonable access and the ability to have capacity. But in your slide on page 15, the third bullet after the third sub-bullet after the third, anyway, going down, it says the contract must provide reasonable certainty that when we discover gas, we'll have access to pipeline capacity. Reasonable certainty to capacity, or what are the terms of reasonable certainty are you talking about here?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that point goes to what was negotiated last year in the old contract, which there really was no requirement on anybody to expand the pipeline. There were a lot of issues that were made about having to have a certain quantity of gas to before the pipeline would be expanded or would even be evaluated to be expanded. We think if it's economic to expand, then it's economic to expand. And if you look at the pipeline companies in the lower 48 that currently operate, that are open access, everybody has access to capacity. If you have the gas supply, then you have access and the ability to put gas on the pipeline and transport it to markets. We want to make sure that we have the same type of access for the Alaska Gas Line. And that's really all that bullet is addressing, is to make sure that if the pipeline is built, if BG doesn't find our gas reserves or adequate gas reserves in the first couple of years, it may be the fourth or fifth year, we then want to be in a position where if we find commercial quantities of reserves that we can then have access to markets to be able to sell that gas.
Okay, let me ask you, what is the stock market capitalization for your company, and then how would that compare to some company that we'd recognize like TransCanada or MidAmerica?
Well, our market cap is roughly, is approximately $45 billion U.S. dollars, and again, it's primarily traded on the London Exchange, so it depends on what the exchange rate is today, but it's in the neighborhood of $45 billion. So I apologize, but I don't know what the market cap is for MidAmerican or for TransCanada.
Okay, and you build pipelines, or you just try to get some other people to build pipelines and then try to partner with them?
We prefer to have other people build the pipelines today. Years ago, we were involved in building pipelines, but as I mentioned earlier, since the demerger, we're really not in the pipeline building business.
Okay, fair enough. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Just a couple of things. So you wanted access, and are you comfortable with the terms of AGEA on page 6 there, where it's a commitment to expand the project for commercially reasonable terms and reasonable engineering increments? Do those follow within, those kind of things give you enough guidance that that's acceptable?
Yes, sir, Representative Seaton, through the chair, absolutely.
Okay, and the other question I had was, you were talking about fiscal certainty and you wanted to see that applied. Do you see fiscal certainty as being a component of building the pipeline, or do you see that as a component of going to open season?
I see that as a component of going to open season.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keene, in this situation where we're looking at, certainly in the contract last year where we had the producers looking to own the pipeline, you're a major supplier of gas. How unique is that to your environment? I mean, do you see that as common around the world, or is it different up here than what you've seen?
I don't think it's Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I don't think it's unreasonable, because in many in our industry around the world, there are many areas where there is no expertise to do that. So, you know, clearly there is expertise here. We have companies that are in the pipeline business that are interested in building this, and I believe that they can do it on a cost-effective basis. As I've said in comments to other people, I would much rather see someone build and own and operate a pipeline who is motivated to increase their revenues by increasing throughput versus someone who is motivated to, or perhaps motivated to, increase revenues by decreasing throughput. So it gives me more comfort to know that there's an independent third-party pipeline company whose business it is to transport natural gas to markets.
So is that what you mean on page 15, when on the bottom bullet point, when you're encouraging the state to enter discussions with independent pipeline companies?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm looking around the room, and there don't appear to be any more questions. Do you want to make a summary statement that says, you know, you're real excited about this and want it to go forward and want to partner with a pipeline company if you can, and have a suggestion of who that may be?
But say whatever you want.
Or other things.
Mr. Chairman, what I would like to say in closing is a point that I alluded to a few minutes ago, and that is that I encourage the committee, I encourage the House and also the Senate to get to a point where we actually have the vehicle in place that will allow for the development of a pipeline. We've seen over the last couple of years, which was the fast track method really became the slow track method, and nothing happened. I'm very encouraged by the process that we're seeing today, all the way from the governor to the speaker to the president of the Senate and to the chairmen of the committees that have jurisdiction in opening this up to public debate.
Please.
So, excuse me. We're very encouraged by this process. We think it will result in a gas pipeline, but I encourage you to not be dragged into the weeds in looking at specific details today, because I think there's time for that down the road. And that's all I would say.
Thank you. And Representative Goddard once again left the room. David, any other questions for David? I just have one. David, how long would you be, are you going to be in a position, and your company going to be in a position, and assuming we're talking a three-year time frame, to bring gas to the first open season?
Representative Johnson, I mean, it's going to be, I think, difficult. As I mentioned, we're going to be drilling the first gas exploratory wells next winter, which is the winter of 2008. So if we're successful and we find we're lucky enough to find gas supply, and I think, you know, we have the technical expertise, so we feel pretty good about things, but we'd probably then do some more serious drilling in the winter of 2009 that may extend to 2010. So depending upon when the license is issued, you know, there's a requirement that the open season be conducted 3 years from that point, within 36 months from that point. So we may not be in a position where we can purchase capacity during the initial open season. We would then hope to be able to do it in the follow-on, but and that's one of the points that, I was making in earlier with regards to the fiscal certainty and the fact that your companies that don't participate in the first open season are not eligible for the even what's prescribed in the bill, which is the 10 years and at the fixed rate. I would encourage the state to take a look at that and find ways in which that can be modified and amended, because if we're diligently producing or exploring for natural gas, I don't think we should be penalized because we weren't able to make that specific window. I do think that having a 36-month time frame is probably not a bad idea, or it could be 48 months, but certainly I wouldn't want to drag it out much longer, because then you're going to start talking about something that may not be delivered by 2018 or 2019.
Okay. Thank you. Representative, some additional questions. You thought you were off the hook, I'm sure. Representative Gutenberg?
Sure. The longer we're on, the more things that come up. But maybe I missed it, but what is if this is an LNG project, and I'm not sure where it would go, whether it ends in Valdez or something else, what market would you be shipping this gas to?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, again, part of what we're discussing today is not an LNG project, but I think, you know, in answer to the question, clearly there are no terminals currently on the west coast of the U.S. And I think there may be one. It's problematic, as that was alluded to earlier. So I think that the market would probably be in the Far East, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. Because you can't deliver it. You can't go through the Panama Canal currently either.
Is that a result of the size of the ships, or is that a regulation problem?
Representative Johnson, I believe that's more a size of the ship, okay. But I'm not positive of that. I believe it's the ship size, though.
Okay, thank you. Any additional? Representative Wilson.
David, you, on your last page here, you've got, at the very last, you've got that you encourage the state to enter into discussions with independent pipeline companies. Now, we're thinking of Mid-America and Trans-Canada, but are there others that might be interested?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I honestly can't speak of others that might be interested. I mean, there are other large pipeline companies, like Encana or El Paso, or there are some of the biggest companies in North America. But I can't speak for them or whether or not they would be interested.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you knew some that we didn't know about. Okay, thank you very much.
Any additional questions? David, thank you so much for testifying. And if we have additional questions, we know how to get in touch with you. But thank you so much. And we all share the same goal of trying to get a pipeline built.
Representative Johnson, thank you very much for allowing me to testify. It's been a real pleasure. And again, I apologize for not being there in person.
It's quite all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I think Kathy Forrester is on the line. And Kathy, I thought I heard you say earlier that you really didn't have testimony. You were just here to answer questions. Is that correct? Kathy, are you there? Okay, let's take a recess and see if we can't get Kathy back on the line, and we'll just recess for about 5 minutes until we get her back on. Other committee members will straggle in as they get done, but we do have Kathy Forrester. Kathy, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, and I'm going to assume it was our problem, not yours.
Well, I think it was a case of not pushing the unmute button.
Oh, I can understand how that happens.
Kathy, but I appreciate you guys letting me do this over the phone. I'm sitting here with my knee in an ice
leave because I had surgery a week ago, so it would not have been possible for me to come. So that's my lame excuse.
And lame is appropriate, no pun intended. Kathy, I understand that you really don't have testimony, but you are here mainly to answer questions. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I would like, if you could, to kind of go through the process that you undertake when you start evaluating the amount of gas that can come out of a field. Can you kind of tell me what kicks that off? Kind of walk the committee through the process that you go through or the commission goes through when it comes time to start exploring that. What kicks it off? What the time frames, et cetera? Can you kind of walk us through that, if you would, as a starting point?
Certainly. Typically what happens is that an operator comes to us and requests a gas allowable offtake in an oil field. And in Prudhoe Bay, that's what will happen. In Point Thompson, what will have to happen first is that we will have to determine whether it should be operated as an oil field or a gas field. And by Alaska statutes and our regulations, it does not meet the criteria of a gas field. The producing parameters meet our requirements for an oil field. So they will have to come to us for an allowable permission to produce it as a gas field, if that's what they decide that they want to do. And so, as I said, typically the operator comes to us and asks for those permissions. However, since our job is to prevent waste of hydrocarbons, and since taking the gas out of an oil field or a condensate field like Point Thompson before all the liquids have been recovered does put those liquids at risk of being lost, i.e. wasted, we do have the authority to call our own hearing if the operator doesn't come to us for that purpose. So either they ask us for a hearing or we call a hearing on our own motion. And in a field like Prudhoe Bay, what we're looking for is, in Prudhoe, there are going to be three big variables. They're going to have to prove to us, show us a timing, a rate, and things that they're going to do to get the oil out, as much of the oil out as they can before that timing starts. Those are the three variables at Prudhoe Bay that we'll be looking at to see what we can allow them to do. They'll have to demonstrate to us that greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery will result by what they propose to do. And our technical staff and consultants will have to evaluate their technical data and say, yes, indeed, that is correct, or no, that is wrong, and here's what should be done.
Okay. Thank you. Is there a way that when you call your own meeting or however you phrased it, do you rely on your own technical data at that point, or are you still relying on the oil company's data? What would you use to, I guess what I'm getting at, there's been some concern that right now there's only, 2.7 BCF allowable offtake of Prudhoe. It's not enough to really do a pipeline. If the administration or you decided to start looking at additional gas output from Prudhoe Bay, would that be something that you would rely on your own technical people, or would you go to the companies? How would that work?
Well, it's already worked.
There's no producer.
It's already almost all worked. The AOGCC on its own motion called a hearing 2 years ago to look at just that, and at the conclusion of our deliberations, we determined that 30 years and 11 billion barrels of oil later, the 2.7 was probably not the right number. Now, we need to reevaluate it. So we entered into an agreement with BP and its partners to do a collaborative study where we used our own technical people, our own technical consultants, and our own data, but primarily relied on
the much more complete and much more technically advanced data and evaluation tools that the operator has at their disposal to incorporate into our study. So we kicked that study off. Let me remember when we started it. I'm going to have to pull out some notes here. We started the study in January of 2006, and we completed it late last year. And in February, we held a public meeting in which our technical staff presented a summary report, which is available on our website. There is additional information that is still being held confidential as part of the agreement we entered into with BP and its partners. But we have completed the technical evaluation. And at such time as BP and its partners come to us requesting a hearing to amend the allowable, then we will make more information. They'll have to provide information as part of a public process, and that information will become available. But there's been a lot of analysis. We have a lot of information. We're pretty far along on the Prudhoe Bay analysis. So if people are worried that we're going to be a stumbling block in the process towards an open season, we very, very deliberately have tried not to do that through this process that we have engaged in. And I'm pretty confident that when the time comes to call for that hearing, we'll be ready for it. And you know, that said, let's talk for a second about Point Thompson, because although we've tried to do the same things at Point Thompson, there have been a lot of problems in getting that done. So as confident that I am and as comfortable as I am that we are adequately prepared to address the Prudhoe Bay gas offtake allowable when that comes before us, unless it's years, you know, unless it's delayed by years, in which case we'll have to update our studies. But if it's within a reasonable amount of time, we're ready to do that. But as confident as I am that we are there, I am very uncomfortable that we are not where we need to be on Point Thompson.
Thank you. When you say a reasonable amount of time, are you talking weeks, months, or years?
I would say if we had a hearing a year from now, a year and a half from now, we'd probably still have sufficient information to require little extra for our own technical folks. We'll be looking to the operators to have been keeping their analyses up to date, and we'll know enough about how their work is extrapolated from what we've already done to feel comfortable with it. So I think a year or so would still be fine. But if it becomes 5 years, then it's not fine. And somewhere between a year and 5 years, it gets gray, and you know, we'll have to judge by what's happened in the field.
Okay, thank you. And how long, if you were to start at day one, what are you looking at in terms of being able to issue an opinion on a new field like Point Thompson or some of the other new explore areas? What would be your start to finish time frame on something new? I realize Point Thompson isn't totally new, but what are you talking about in terms of holding the hearings, gathering the data? What's your best and worst case scenario?
Well, you know, the best case scenario is the one that we tried to embark upon. We tried to have a similar agreement. Well, we do have a similar agreement with the Point Thompson folks. After we had success in doing the one at Prudhoe, we started down that same path with Point Thompson. And on April last year, we reached a similar agreement for a study at Point Thompson similar to the one we did at Prudhoe. And we were supposed to start it in September of last year, but, you know, one delay or another, we didn't actually get to start it till about the time the DNR found Exxon in default. So we had one meeting that gave us a little tiny bit of the data that we need, and then Exxon and its partners decided they needed to focus their energies on their legal issues and put this on hold. But then in February, they came back and told us, you know, we really need to keep things moving, so let our legal people worry our legal issues and let our technical people work with you on our technical work. Well, That was a month and a half ago, and just a few days ago, I was told by similar Exxon representatives that they've changed their mind, that they're not going to be doing anything with us until they resolve all their legal issues. So perfect scenario would have been that we would have continued on this path, and we would probably take 6 months to do our technical analysis, and then we'd be prepared for them to come to us for pool rules, in which we would determine, is it an oil field, is it a gas field? If there can be a gas offtake, what will it be? Do you have to cycle the gas first to get the liquids out of the ground? Or, you know, what is going to be your development scenario? So that would be the perfect case. In an imperfect case, they'll have to come to us to get pool rules and the ability to sell gas. And we won't be able to make a ruling without sufficient data, so we'll be completely at the mercy of what amount of data they want to give us, and then how long it takes us to pour through that data. And, you know, just in a black and white engineer's world, the kind of reservoir that Point Thompson is a gas condensate reservoir. And in a reservoir like that, if you do not cycle, in other words, if you do not reinject the gas over and over again to strip out the liquids, you are wasting hydrocarbons, and you are violating the mandates of our commission. And the volume of liquid hydrocarbons that we're putting at risk here is comparable to an alpine field. So it's not a sneeze. You know, there are hundreds of millions of barrels of liquid hydrocarbons at risk if we don't do it right at Point Thompson. So we can't just say, oh, Point Thompson operator, just do whatever you want to do. Let's get that gas pipeline going, because there are hundreds of millions of barrels of liquid hydrocarbons that could be lost if we don't do our job. Did that answer your question, or was that just a soap opera? I mean, a soapbox.
Yes.
Yes to both? Yeah.
One additional question, and I guess, and I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. Let's assume we get some kind of agreement, we get a licensing, we go to open season in 36 months. Is it reasonable to expect that producers would have enough information and a ruling on the pooling data from you to take that gas to open season?
In 36 months, with Prudhoe Bay where we are right now, not a problem. With Point Thompson, we need to get data and information and get an evaluation going.
And is that a yes or a no on Point Thompson? In 36 months?
You'll have to ask Exxon if they're going to give us the data and let us do an evaluation. Because without any data, their answer is no.
And with data, you think you could 36 months is reasonable?
Oh, if we start doing a study, if we get back on track and start doing our study, 36 months, I mean, is just cushy. It's pretty darn comfortable. I would say if push came to shove, we could get it done in a year. 3 years is pretty darn comfortable.
Okay, thank you. And that's kind of what I was looking at. If we can get all the legal issues settled, we're still not going to be too far behind the curve as long as we have 12 months or so.
Right.
Put it together.
Right.
Representative Gutenberg?
Thank you. A couple of questions, and it doesn't sound like these were asked before. I came in late. I'm sorry. What data are you looking for to mine out of what they can give you? And would you like in future reservoirs releases that you had the ability to have some of this data confidential, so that?
Well, this data will be confidential if they provide it to us. However, when we come to a hearing, we'll have to have enough of it made non-confidential so that the public can feel comfortable that we have done the right thing. So, whatever data they give us, it will be held confidential, but they're not required to give it to us right now. The data that we're looking for would be enough reservoir description data to demonstrate to us that their plan of development will not waste hydrocarbons. So what we would need is reservoir description. We'll need geophysical data, seismic data, and interpretation of that. We'll need a geological interpretation and just factual data so that we can do our own geological interpretation. Then we'll need reservoir modeling runs based on those geophysical and geological interpretations.
a lot of science, geology, and engineering data.
Additional question?
I'm just.
You don't have to.
Well, no. I mean, sometimes it takes a while to perk up. But have you found that the fields across Prudhoe, whether it's Alpine, Caparic, or Prudhoe, that they're similar in nature?
That's a really broad question. In what way do you mean similar? That's like saying, are five men similar?
Well, if you found, some of us have beards and some of us don't, but if you found, you're looking for data to do projections on this, how are they capped? What kind of geological structure is the gas or the oil mixed together? How many different ways have you already found that things like that have happened? I'm under the impression that Point Thompson's significantly different.
Point Thompson is significantly different from Prudhoe Bay, yes. And determining that it's okay to take gas out of one field has nothing to do with whether or not it's okay to take gas out of another field.
Okay, so basically, if I may, basically it is a whole nother project.
Right. We have to start entirely over with Point Thompson and do a separate analysis. It's a totally different kind of field. We're not even looking to answer the same questions. The questions at Prudhoe Bay are when, how much, and what are you going to do in the meantime to get as much oil as you can out of the ground? Because it's a multivariable equation. The amount of gas we'll let them produce depends on when they're going to start doing it, and what they've done in the meantime to get as much oil out of the ground as they can. And at Point Thompson, it really is, can you get better ultimate recovery by cycling or by not cycling? And if you don't think you're going to cycle, what are you going to do to get those liquid hydrocarbons out? So it's totally different. So, it's like a doctor saying all of his patients are the same.
So if I may, tell me what happens when you you declare that it's a gas field instead of an oil field?
Point Thompson?
Yeah.
If we declared that Point Thompson was a gas field and not an oil field, then they wouldn't have to get an allowable from us. They could produce as much gas as they wanted. But if we declared that it was an oil field, then they'd have to reinject all of the gas until we're satisfied that they've recovered the liquid hydrocarbons, or they'd have to come to us for a gas allowable and demonstrate to us that the allowable offtake that they want isn't going to put those liquid hydrocarbons at risk.
Representative Seaton.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, I'm trying to kind of coordinate what we've been talking about here in the recommendation on the February 28th 2007, in that first paragraph where it says that the Prudhoe Bay WIO, that's a working group model, evaluation and studies that have been shared with us are not sufficient to justify an allowable above that specified in Rule 9. So I'm curious as to where we are. It seems to be that the model, I think above that, the first paragraph says the model results based on equivalent EOFL rate limits consistently show that the total energy recovery is substantially decreased with an earlier and higher rate of gas sale. So I guess I'm trying to square the report from the commission with the idea that all they have to do is kind of apply and we'll get a higher gas take. Offtake. Am I misreading the report?
I think what the report is saying is that there's still a lot of uncertainty, but we, in order to give them an offtake, we have to know from them what they're going to do in the meantime to get as much oil out as they can, as quickly as they can, and when they plan to start selling gas. Because, as I said before, it's a multivariable equation. The the answer, what you put in for A and B determines what the answer is for C. A is when are you going to start, B is what are you going to be doing in the meantime, and C is how much is safe to put to take out of gas. So without knowing when they're going to start, I mean, if they wanted to start tomorrow, the answer would be zero. But if they're going to start in 20 years, the answer would be do whatever the heck you want. So we, you know, it, that I think what the that par, what the report says is we have to know when they're going to start, and we have to know the things they're going to be doing in the next 5, 10, whatever, however many years, to maximize oil production, so that when we get to that point that they're ready to sell, we know how much oil is left in the ground.
Okay. And
follow up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So if this was an earlier start, they would still be allowed the 2 BCF a day, right?
If they had the ability to sell the gas tomorrow and we caught wind that they were going to, we'd call a hearing and take the rate and take a look, hard look at whether that rate should be zero or whether 2 was okay. The only reason we have not taken the gas allowable offtake rate away is because there's nothing they're going to be able to do about it. You know, I'm not sure that 2 would be okay today. When this thing was put in place 30 years ago, we had no data on that reservoir. We had no production from that reservoir, and we had no data. Well, we had some data on it, but we had no production data on it. And we have 30 years and 11 billion barrels of production now. We know a heck of a lot more. And if somebody wanted to sell gas at Prudhoe Bay today, I'd be really uncomfortable with it, because every puff of that gas that they're producing, they're reusing either to keep the pressure up and keep the reservoir energy up to get the oil out of the ground, or they're using it for EOR, enhanced oil recovery, in Prudhoe Bay, or they're importing it to other fields for EOR. So it's not like that gas is sitting there doing nothing. That gas is making us oil right now. So the short answer to your question is no. I'm not sure that they'd be allowed to produce 2 BCF today if they had a line.
Representative Seaton?
Well, thanks. So I guess we're going through AGEA. We're trying to get to a open season. And I guess what we're saying is we don't know if there'll be any gas available for an open season unless the folks that have the leases put in a request for a new offtake rule so that they or and anyone else will know whether there's going to be gas available. I guess they could take FT and just say we're going to base it on just maybe not having any gas to sell, but we'll come to bid. Or they might just say, well, we don't know what it'll be, so therefore we're not going to bid. And until there is an application for a new rule, everything's just on hold. Is that basically where we're looking at?
Until there's an application for gas offtake allowable, everything is on hold. But it's at Prudhoe Bay, we're ready. Whenever the operator wants to come to us for a gas allowable, you know, all they have to tell us is what their depletion plan is in the meantime and when they want to start, and we'll work with them to develop an allowable offtake that will ensure the greater ultimate recovery of those hydrocarbons from Prudhoe Bay. And as soon as whoever, whether it's Exxon, you know, I'm sure they're uncomfortable about proceeding with this because of their tenuous legal status, but I think that if they are sincere in believing that they are going to prevail, then their legal people can fight their legal battles, and their technical people can work the technical issues, and we could get about doing our business. And so they could come to us, we could do our technical studies, and a year from now we'd be ready to have a hearing for them as well. So, you know, if open season is 3 years away, we got plenty of time for them to get their work done and get an allowable. You know, we're fitting into their critical time path without any constraints right now. I don't think there's any reason anyone should be alarmed that we're going to be a stumbling block or that there's going to be unknowns. In plenty of time for open season, we can resolve these issues.
Representative Seaton, follow up?
I think that is, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, Kathy.
Any additional questions for Kathy? Kathy, I'm sure I have a lot more, but I think that maybe now's not the time. I would like an opportunity to talk to you in the future and maybe come back before the committee. You may have caused more questions than you answered today.
I apologize for that.
That's okay. No, that's good. That's what we're here for, is to try to filter through this stuff and get to the bottom of it.
Well, and I did want to say one other thing. I know it can appear frustrating that we can appear to be a stumbling block, because I know everybody, you know, most Alaskans are really pumped about this gas line, and everyone knows that there are 35 trillion cubic feet of gas just waiting to fill that pipeline. However, you know, how many people talk about the hundreds of millions of barrels of oil and condensate that our commission here is trying to protect? So, you know, we're not trying to be a stumbling block. We are trying to do what the Constitution tells us we're supposed to do, which is get as much of that stuff, both the liquid and the gas, out of the ground and preserve the resource of the people of Alaska. So, you know, we're trying to, the oil is the bird in our hand, and the gas is the bird in our bush, and our job is to try to ensure that we don't harm that bird in our hand while we're trying to grab that bird in the bush. So I apologize for frustrating you guys, but we really are trying to do the best for the people of Alaska by their hydrocarbon resource.
Thank you. And I think everyone appreciates that, and I certainly do. We're just trying to get our hands around how's the best way to make this happen.
And I will make myself available to you telephonically until such time as my knee doctor gives me permission to get back on a plane, and then I'll come and see you anytime you want.
It's a short walk down to the airport. No, I appreciate that. Having been through that, I know it's not any fun. Are there any additional questions for Kathy? I just one more. You said that earlier, one of the first things you said is, you know, after 30 years that the 2 BCF wasn't probably the number, and that you've done some research on it. Is that something, can you share that with us, or is that something that is so hypothetical at this point? Is the number 1.7, 3.7, or did I mishear what you said?
Okay. You know, I apologize for thinking and talking like an engineer, but I are one, so please forgive me. It's a multivariable equation. I can't tell you what the gas offtake is unless you can tell me when they're going to start producing and what they've done in the meantime to get oil out of the ground. How much oil is left in the ground?
Yeah, I got that, but you know, earlier the first thing you said earlier was that that it probably wasn't the number, so I was maybe thinking you might have one.
There's not a number,
and I will not put you on the spot with that.
And even if there were a number, what's in the public document that you guys have access to from our website is all we have permission from the Prudhoe Bay owners to make public, because we did sign a confidentiality agreement so we could do this study, and it is in the best interest of the state that we did this study. And when we have a hearing, we'll make as much as we can and as much as makes sense publicly available, but until that time, we are bound by a confidentiality agreement. So even if I had a number, I couldn't tell you.
And I think that's probably the answer I was expecting. Any additional questions? Kathy, thank you so much. I wish you a speedy recovery and hope to see you down in Juneau in the very near future.
Well, I promise I'll come see you guys as soon as I can. And again, thank you for your patience with my engineering babble.
That's quite all right. You did a very good job of making it understandable, at least to me. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you all.
Anything else to come before the committee today? Hearing nothing, we will stand adjourned. It is 2:45.
Is that for timing for...